Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. And yeah, the people have spoken and we have our panel here raring to go. CSI referendum, as we're calling them today. They're going to sift over the forensic evidence. Some of the front pages first. Varadkar, we failed public on referendum. The Sunday Times says embarrassing defeat won't force election, vows Taoiseach. The Sunday Independent has an exclusive. They have an exit poll and they say it reveals the anger behind the no vote. Lack of clarity, mistrust cited as reasons for rejection. Varadkar blames coalition for failure to win Mainz. The Irish Mail on Sunday walloped. The Mirror kicking the ballots, and the Business Post has gone with Shannon water pipeline delays a threat to foreign investment, which is probably in a way more important in the long run. But we are not in the long run now. We are where we are. So let's have a look at things. I'm joined by Brenda Power, who is a columnist at the Irish Daily Mail and the Sunday Times, and was a no campaigner. Aideen Hayden, housing expert, former chair of Threshold, former Labour Party senator and a Yes Yes campaigner. Jennifer Bray is an Irish Times political reporter. Bobby McDonough is former ambassador to the UK and the EU. And I'm joined on the phone by Dr. Margaret Kennedy, who is the founder of Equality Not Care. And Margaret has been a tireless campaigner for disability rights down the years. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Brenda.
Good morning.
Brenda, can I ask you first, what happened here?
As I said, the people have spoken, and I think this is an overwhelming affirmation of the role of women in the home and in society, in the community. And it has to be read as that. People had the opportunity to take women and mothers out of the constitution and chose not to do so.
Well, it's also the right to take them out of the home. The opportunity to take them out of the home is how it was portrayed. That their place is not in the home. That's what we
I think there was a survey about 2 weeks ago which found that 70% of women currently working outside the home for reasons of economic necessity would prefer to be at home. So, I mean, what was affirmed was the aspiration, and that's all it ever was, to support women who would prefer to stay at home. And also, as I think Mary Baker and Susan Denham both said, to pay tribute to the significant role that women play in the household and in the home and in the community, and the fact that without that effort, the common good cannot be achieved. And that has been reaffirmed. And
you
people
think that was the main reason?
I do. I know that the care element was something that concerned people, and the fact that care shouldn't just simply be confined to the home. And I think Senator Tom Clonan was very strong in asserting that particular oversight or omission in the wording. But I do think, just from my own experience, Brendan, talking to women over the last couple of weeks, that was troubling them. That they didn't see what was sexist or reductive about women's work or the reference to women. And, you know, the fact that it was portrayed as somehow, I think the word relegated to domestic duty was used by some politicians. The suggestion that women who worked at home or chose to be at home or wanted to be at home with their kids were somehow kind of third division women, and that women who worked outside the home were Premier League, and that there was, you know, there was a sort of an implicit criticism or a suggestion that to want to be at home with your kids was somehow a belittling activity. And I think women responded badly to that.
Okay. Jennifer Bray, you were watching this very forensically the last couple of weeks, watching what everyone was saying, watching what was going on. You were there all weekend and everything. What do you think happened?
I think there's a couple of things, really. And if there was any one reason, then I think the government would be able to kind of fall back and say that it was only this one thing. But because there were so many different things that happened that culminated in this going so badly wrong, I mean, it's the highest percentage no vote in the history of our referendum.
That's the care one.
That's the care one, which is
3-1, like.
Extraordinary slapdown for the government. And I think what happened, the first thing was that they rushed the campaign. They really did. Now, they say they worked on it behind closed doors, on the wording, that is, devising it. But when it actually came to come forward, the Dáil and the Shannon, there was the use of the guillotine, there was no pre-legislative scrutiny, so politicians felt rushed into making decision on the opposition benches. Now, a lot of them rode in, apart from Aintree, of course. So there was that element to it as well. I think as well, the government was not proactive in the campaign. I got the impression that the vast majority, particularly senior politicians, just wanted to stay out of it. And during the course of the campaign, I covered it from the beginning, I would ring people up and say, you know, what's the story with the campaign this week? Like, what events are coming up? And I would always get this sentiment of, oh God, I can't believe you're ringing me about this because you're not re-ringing me about something more interesting. They themselves weren't that interested. And that's the truth of it. Their campaign was very lackluster then, I think. And I think a lot of people felt left behind. That's the truth. I think a lot of people felt, you know, like Brenda mentioned, women who felt kind of relegated. That was a real thing. I was outside a polling station on Friday and loads of women said that to me. Why on International Women's Day are we taking the word mother and women out of the constitution? Now, I understand there's a context around it. A big one was the disability campaigners. With the National Women's Council, obviously, were the biggest group to come out in terms of the NGOs. But there were loads of umbrella groups within the National Women's Council that covered by them who actually felt we are leaving behind huge cohorts of women here, disabled women. And people my age, like I'm in my mid-30s, friends of mine got in touch with me to say, I actually don't feel comfortable going into the voting booth and voting for something that would be good for me because I don't agree with the wording, but would be bad for a huge cohort of women. I think those couple of things all came together, combine it with a lackluster campaign, combine it with some pretty poor media performances from the government. And I do think there was an element to giving the government a kick. I really do. I think there was a bit of, well, this is vague, this is confusing. We feel like you're not giving us full information. Here's a wallop.
Yeah, and there were a lot of don't knows in the last opinion poll we saw last weekend, and they all seemed they did that thing of if you don't know, vote no, maybe. Okay, that brings us to you, Dr. Margaret Kennedy. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you campaigned against the care referendum with your Equality Not Care campaign group. As a disabled person, what was your problem with it?
Well, it wasn't only my problem. With the three of us got together, Michael O'Dowd, myself, and Anne-Marie Flanagan. And we just said, what is this wording all about? And we set up Equality Not Care. And what we meant by that was that we disabled people had to have the equality. And we were not, this referendum didn't speak of equality. It spoke of care. But we don't like this model of medical model that we would be cared for, looked after in this rather patronising, infantilising way by our families, perhaps. And it said in the wording something along the lines that because of the bonds that hold us together in these families, that the families would care for the whoever in their family. And, well, we knew that there are many, many disabled people living in very unpleasant circumstances within families who really were negative and not terribly caring. Now, I'm not saying that all families at all, but I'm saying that there is a proportion. And, you know, to assume that every person who's going to be looked after is going to be in a happy situation is not reality.
And Margaret,
the other thing that we didn't like...
Yeah, sorry, go ahead and finish.
The other thing we didn't like was the fact that it said because the women in the home or the people in the home would now look after and care for the people in the house. And that took an onus off the state for the common good. And we felt like we were burdened, that we were being cast as burdens on society. And so families would look after us, but the state wouldn't. And there was no recognition that the state had any responsibility for disabled citizens or sick citizens or elderly citizens. In fact, I think we've been left behind. Very much left behind. And we felt very angry about that. And then the third one was Stride. Of course, Stride wasn't going to produce anything, and we knew that. And we were very let down by the women in the Dáil and the, you know, Oireachtas, because we felt you haven't got the intersectionality right. You spoke about women, but you never spoke about us, disabled women. And so nobody spoke about disabled women, really.
Did you think that this was kind of like the equivalent of they were talking over to your heads to the people who look after you? Is that how it felt to you, like that kind of infantilizing and putting you in a box there and that we'll...
Exactly. It was totally infantilizing. I call it patronizing politics. And I actually met Leo Veronica yesterday. I had a chat with him in the foyer in Dublin Castle, and I said to him, I was sorry about his troubles at this point in time. And I said, I think back to the drawing board. And then I said to him, where to next? And I meant where to next in relation to disabled people, sick people and older people whom we were representing. And he said, the next election. And he had nothing to offer on the plate for this particular referendum. It was gone now. He was very nonchalant, very quiet about it. And he was moving on.
Okay, well, look, in fairness, I'm sure he was smarting a bit at that stage, and he's not here to give his side to that conversation, so I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Margaret, is there a sense that disabled people, you've probably had this all your life, are you supposed to be grateful for things like this and for whatever bit of kind of good vibes and good feeling thrown your way?
We have to be very grateful. And we're constantly told how hard society is right now and how costly it is and what about other people, that there are other people that have to be grateful to. And we're put down in that regard. And I think that what this referendum showed, that the general public understood when we disabled people got onto the platform and started talking about the reality of our lives. I think disabled people were heard by the general population. They knew that we were being patronized. They knew we were being infantilized. And they said, enough is enough. And I actually came home last night. I was in Dublin Castle, and I absolutely bawled crying after the result was read, because I couldn't believe in the first place that this amendment was out there. Couldn't believe my government could be so naive. But I think I was very positive, very strong in my soul and my heart that the people of Ireland really said, what about disabled people, sick people and elderly people now? Give them, give equality. And they stuck to the equality, I think, very, very well. Very delighted. I want to thank everybody who supported us.
So, Margaret, to use the modern parlance, you feel seen, you feel heard.
Sorry, say that again.
To use the modern phrases, you feel seen, you feel heard, do you?
I'm not quite getting you what
you feel. You feel as if you've been listened to, as if you've been seen, as if people have.
Definitely. Absolutely, definitely. I'm sitting here in the MS Care Centre in Ireland at the moment. I have a week here. And, I just feel so upheld by the state. Not to say that by the people of Ireland, not by our government, but I feel upheld. I feel really buoyant that the people came out and they're beginning to think about disability in a new way, impairment in a new way, illness and older people in a new way. We're slowly coming up to equality in the people's mind, but I don't think we're coming up to equality in the government's mind. And I think I told Leo Varadkar, you have to have a rights model approach and you have to have an equality model approach, and if we needed anybody to go in and present anything on disability and equality, we don't have a rights-based approach here in this country.
We have signed up for the UN. The Declaration on the Rights of People with Disabilities.
But there's a but there, because they never ratified the option approach, which means you can't even use it.
I think they're always on the verge of ratifying. Okay, Margaret, stay with us. I want to bring in some of the others. Aideen, you were yes. What happened here?
Well,
your reflections.
Look, obviously it's disappointing, but I think the writing was on the wall in the last week or 10 days. In terms of women in the home, I think the real issue was that people felt something was being taken away from them, rather than something was being given to them and something was being added. And I think,
is that a failure then of wording, of communication?
Yes. I mean, I do think it was a failure. It was a failure of wording. It was a failure of communication. And it was also a failure of the campaign in terms of, I think the government went into this in all sincerity, but I don't think they did the work that they needed to do. We've seen from numerous other referendums in this country, I mean, just taking for the sake of argument, the divorce referendum. Fine Gael took the view in 1986 that they went into that referendum with a two-thirds majority. And the campaign at the end of the day took that into a no vote, a significant no vote. When they went back to put that referendum again, they did the groundwork. They put in the legislation around separation, around judicial separation, and they left it into a position where the only difference between divorce and separation was the right to remarry. The big difficulty here is that in some of the things that the government did, they were happy to just take high line, high level aspirations and not put in the work to say, OK, what does a durable relationship look like? Let's put forward an explanation as to what that is, whether that be legislative explanation or, you know, the grounds of what could be a potential piece of legislation.
So
they also failed.
So do you think a lot of the people in the more civil society end of the SES campaign would be like you now, blaming the government for this?
Yes, I do, actually, because I also think that...
Did the Yes civil society NGO campaigners not fail here as well to make a compelling case?
There was certainly no question or doubt that the division among the civil society campaigners was important. I think specifically the role of FLAC, you know, an organisation that would be very highly regarded in taking the view that it did on the care provision. I think that was very influential. We went into this with the idea that everybody was behind it. And that's always a mistake, I think, in any campaign, as we've seen from numerous referenda campaigns.
Did we think traditionally that all right-thinking people, if you want to call it that, all good liberals and everything, did feel that the Constitution saying that, which it didn't say a woman's place is in the home, but known as the woman's place in the home article, that this was a real bugbear for, you know, new generations of women, didn't we?
Well, look, if you ask people 2 years ago, just around, you know, as put in one of the articles in the Sunday Times, if you ask the chattering classes what they thought of the women in the home provision, they would have all said demeaning, want it out. But in the course of a campaign, you have to be aware that a lot of the issues that are going on in the wider society at any moment in time, and I think that's important, Brendan. I do think there's a lot of uncertainty in Irish society at the moment. There's a lot of uncertainty about migration. That was certainly played up to in the course of this campaign. There's a lot of uncertainty about where people stand. And I think there's uncertainty about the role of women in Irish society. And that came across in this referendum. People, you know, who have caring duties, want to be recognised and want to be acknowledged. And in our society, that is mainly women. I think the sadness about this referendum is that others who are in those roles now will go away today with almost, looking at some of the coverage of this, less feeling that society cares about them than they would have had maybe a month or 2 months ago. And I think that's unfortunate. And I do think it's going to be a step backwards. And I think Margaret kind of hit on it in a way. I mean, unfortunately, as happens in these political events, this issue has now gone away. I mean, the next thing is going to be the local and European elections. It is not going to be revisiting some of these issues and putting forward the legislation that's needed to deal with them. And I think that is an incredible loss. And my feeling still is that if these two referendums had gone forward, I don't think anybody would have been any worse off today than they were yesterday.
Yeah, I wonder if people could fail to see how they would be better off as well. Bobby, what do you think happened?
Well, I think, first of all, we had a calm, rational and respectful debate and we should celebrate our democracy. I think some people had very clear ideas of why they were voting no. And we've heard from Brenda and Margaret about that. But I think many people were also confused and uncertain. And I think the arguments on the side of the no vote were diverse. Some were very strong, but they were quite diverse. Michael McDowell is quoted in today's paper as saying he was a one-man band and he wasn't comfortable with some of the other people on that side of the argument. So it's not clear what wording to amend the relevant articles would win a majority. I doubt if most people have suddenly become more conservative on social issues or that there'll be a huge surge in support for AIN-TU, although I could be wrong. But I think there is a relatively conservative approach to changing our constitution. People want to be absolutely sure what they're doing when they change our constitution.
OK, before I go back to Margaret, can I ask Brenda about that? Is this a conservative clout.
No, I don't believe it is, and I think it is unfair to characterise it in that way. And you know, that was one of the sort of warnings we were given in advance.
You mentioned the chattering classes there. The chattering classes. Some people are now kind of saying the chattering classes and the NGOs have the government captured here, yeah. And they're not listening to ordinary people.
Yeah, I mean, the
liberal chattering classes got a wake up call.
The fact that even Dunleary wrote down, as it turned out. Which looked to be shaping up to be, I think, the word was the Roscommon of this particular referendum. If you remember, they went against same-sex marriage. That even Dunleary rat down over not overwhelmingly, but supported this. I think it is. You know, I think it's unfair to characterise it as a conservative backlash. And I mean, Bobby mentioned the fact that Michael McDougall said he was uncomfortable with some of the no campaigners. He was speaking specifically about Conor McGregor, and he wasn't talking about any of the other people who were on the same side as him in this.
Okay.
I think it is an injustice to suggest that we were warned, that we would be more or less the laughingstock of Europe if we voted for this. We were the first country in Europe to vote for same-sex marriage 9 years ago. And I mean, it is not sexist to have a word like mother in the constitution. The German basic law has a provision which says all mothers shall be entitled to the care and protection of the community. Now, I don't know that John Charles McQuaid had a hand in drafting that, but they don't seem to find that embarrassing.
Some people have made the point that some of the constitutions in Europe did have their roots in kind of fascist thinking, though.
But I mean, I will come back to the fact that I think women felt that there was something not entirely healthy in the desire to take the word woman out. I mean, basically, this is the same government that tried to remove the words woman and mother from maternity protection legislation. We were to be people who got pregnant. And in this case, the word woman was to be, women were to be family carers in circumstances where, according to figures produced by the National Women's Council just 2 weeks ago, 98% are women. So to deny the reality of women's lives and to pretend that this is gender neutral work was something that rankled.
I know Carers Ireland, I saw Catherine Cox disputing those figures and saying there are a lot more men in that, but the substantial point is taken. Margaret Kennedy, can I go back to you? You seem to feel that, are we maybe at some, and look, I suppose you've probably felt we've been at this point down the years that there have been moments, but do you feel we're at a moment where people have actually paid attention to disabled people, that there might be some kind of moment here, there might be some momentum to be grabbed onto in terms of changing how we view disabled people in our society?
I absolutely do, and I am absolutely delighted by that. We were thinking last night, well, what have we gained on this?
Yeah.
And we said one of the gains was the people's hearts and minds. Whether or not, if we go back to this conservative notion of the conservative notion and policies operating here, we feel attacked by our government policies right now. I mean, next week there's another big rally in Dublin on disability issues, where the Green Paper, where the government intend to categorise disabled people into various categories. Now, this they tried to do in England, which was very much a conservative proposition. We're out in the street. Well, I won't be out in the streets, but people are out in the streets on Tuesday at 12 o'clock in O'Connell Street about the Green Paper. Scrap it. Because we're not going to be targeted like this anymore. We're not going to be treated like we're taking too much money off the station or so forth. And I think the people are behind us, and I'm absolutely delighted.
Tom Clonan said last night that Margaret...
The other side to that, can I just say the other side to that is that the other parties who are not on the whole Conservative, Sinn Féin, Social Democrats, PBB, Labour, were voting yes. And we were absolutely stunned that those parties that some of us might have voted were going down that route. And we were trying to say to them, well, what about us? We don't like this model. And what about, it was very, very upsetting, really, that was. We didn't feel supported there, but we do feel supported by the people of Ireland, and we're delighted.
Okay. Can I ask you a final question quickly, because I have to go to a break? Tom Clonan, obviously not a disabled person, but a great ally, I think, and a carer. He said last night that after all this, he thinks we need to have a big conversation in this country about ableism. Do you think we do? And I wonder what would it look like?
About what?
Ableism.
Oh, ableism is the notion that the society is run by and for only people who are well and not disabled. Ableism is a very, very big sword that's chopping us to pieces here. And non-disabled people really must understand that ableism, that is the exclusion of disabled people and ill people and older people, is actually very, very rooted in politics. And we have to get it out of politics, we have to get it out of education, we have to get it out of medicine. It is a shocking, almost like a disease in its own right, that is eating away at a whole community. And yes, we will have to tackle it, and we have to tackle it sharply as a discrimination. And just like racism and other forms of discrimination, ableism is abhorrent.
Dr. Margaret Kennedy, thank you so much. And Brenda Power, Aideen Hayden and Jennifer Bray and Bobby McDonough are staying with us, and we'll take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice on pain management at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Brenda Power, Aideen Hayden, Jennifer Bray and Bobby McDonough are still with us. Dr. Margaret Kennedy has left us, but she has left her mark, I think. Bobby, would we move on a bit to the actual politics, party politics of this? You picked Hugh O'Connell's piece in the Sunday Independent. Blame game begins as referendum's defeated.
Yeah, I thought, I mean, there was a lot of good writing in the papers today about it, but that one struck me. And one of the points in it was the point about Michael McDowell saying that there wasn't complete agreement on the no side. I mean, the specific person that he mentioned was Conor McGregor, but he said, and other people that he didn't agree with.
Well, I think there were different campaigns on different aspects
Exactly. Yeah. So my point about that is that we now have a constitution, and I'm totally comfortable with the outcome, but we have a constitution that retains a definition of the family that probably doesn't reflect society as it is now, and also contains language about women's duties in the home. And let me say, I absolutely agree with Brenda. It's one of the things I care most passionately about, that women should have an absolute equal right to stay in the home if that's what they want to do. But I think there are a lot of people, possibly even on the no side, who would remain a little bit uncomfortable with that sort of language. And I'd be surprised if those sort of wording issues or the other issues that people have raised, very legitimate issues, will be addressed again for several years in our constitution. So, look,
where does it leave the politicians? I mean, egg on their faces today.
Certainly.
Any below the waterline damage ongoing?
Well, I mean, look, there are political correspondents here who can say better than me. But given that pretty well all of the political parties were lined up on one side of the debate, means that the impact may be quite limited. But I think we have avoided the things that most people feared about this referendum, but we do retain some elements in the constitution that possibly are a bit retro, and we will live it with it. The sky hasn't fallen down. And I doubt if the sort of issues, either that wording or some of the other issues that people have mentioned in the course of this morning, will be addressed for quite a number of years yet. But that's the nature of democracy.
Okay. Aideen, you picked a piece in the Sunday Times, Referendum Results Reveals Political Class is Out of Touch. You also picked another one, Gary Murphy's column, Result is Crushing Beaufort Eater. Has this done political damage?
Well, I just picked those because I think it represents two types of reporting. One, you know, political parties are being ruled by the chattering classes, the NGOs, university lecturers, activists, people who sort of believe in, and this is one of the, I thought the interesting lines of
it's
this
the
article,
editorial, yeah.
People actually believe in evidence-based policy. And, you know, that was being just juxtapositioned against the swathe, obviously, of voters who don't buy into this. That was one article. And then there was another article saying...
Have they a point?
The point is, I guess, have they got a point? Well, you know, if we actually get to a point where we throw out evidence-based research and policy, well, you know, I think that brings us into mob rule. And I think there was a certain amount, if you don't mind my saying so, in the second article that I picked out, of triumphalism. a particular individual, for example, citing this referendum result as an end to wokeism, as giving the political system a kick in its shins and, you know, which a wake-up call.
Sorry, which piece was this in?
Sorry, it was in the... Well, I'd have to go back to my list, Brendan.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
But it's there and it's citing... In fact, Michael McDool is and Tom Clunan obviously come in for great accolades from the particular branch of this particular organisation who are basically saying this is a wake-up call and that the political system doesn't understand particularly the concerns of Ireland outside of the particular urban areas. And I just think what we're seeing here is an attempt by the no vote to capture all of the no lobby as some sort of reflection on an Ireland that we all want to go back to, an Ireland that is angry about wokeism, an Ireland that is angry about immigration, an Ireland that doesn't think the political system understands its concerns. Now, there's obviously merit in all of this, but I would not think that that is the situation. I think a lot of the campaign that we've seen both in both referenda really did reflect what I would say is one of the strengths of the Irish voters. And that is, you know, they are curious. They want to know. They want to be informed. And in this situation, I don't think they got the evidence that they wanted to make the decisions that they should be making.
Okay.
Sorry, no, I just wanted to come in there. I think it's interesting that it's triumphalism when your side loses, but it's celebration when your side wins. I was there in Dublin Castle last night and I thought it was hugely graceless of the government to have nobody there to hear the answer to the question that they had put to the people. There was nobody from the government for the reading of the result.
Can I just ask you?
No, but
do you think it was graceful for Mary Lou MacDonald to be interrupted and shouted at and basically I would call the accusations that were levelled at her demeaning. I don't think that was remotely graceful.
I didn't see that. I was at the count when the results were announced, and there was nobody from any of the parties that had promoted and pushed and encouraged people to vote in a particular way there to hear the answer that they got. They didn't like it, so they scurried off. And I mean, I think, you know, to characterise the fact that some people are welcoming this result as triumphalism, I can just imagine how mobbed Dublin Castle would have been last night had the result gone a very different way, and it would never have been described as triumphalism. And I'd, you know, just coming back to the political fallout, Brendan, I'd be interested to see now if the government will publish those interdepartmental documents that they said they would release after the referendum was over, so as we can see the extent of the
which
mayhem. These are the documents relating to the impact that was predicted on immigration, on social welfare, on tax law,
the full AG advice,
between also the departmental documents as in the various departments.
Right.
Whether or not we will get a chance to see the magnitude of the mayhem that I think people actually spared them, because it is clear from the Attorney General's advice that we're not given a correct read on how durable relationships would play out, and in fact that he had concerns about the fact that policymakers would have to address durable relationships in terms of surrogacy, in terms of social welfare, in terms of childcare, and also that there was, you know, that there was a debate over whether or not to add an S to the end of the word relationships, whether that would limit to a particular type of relationship or open up a broad range of relationships. But what he said was, and again we were more or less assured this wasn't the case, that there was no way of knowing how the courts would interpret this.
Okay. Jennifer, as a political reporter, so objective on all of this, last night I think some people were a bit struck by the fact that it was completely deserted by the time the results were read out.
Yeah, I know that Roderick O'Gorman, the minister, line minister for this referendum, that he did shake Michael McDool's hand just before the first result came in, but I didn't see any government representative there for either result. I was in the constituency results centre. I've never seen a smaller crowd on the announcement of any kind of result, whether it's election or referendum, and I've been at the last two referendum counts. It was really extraordinary. And even when the returning officer read out the final result, the people cheering were a small group in the corner, and I'm not diminishing the no side whatsoever. I'm just saying the no side were so, there was such a lack of representation across the political spectrum. Aintu was the only party that actually campaigned for a no vote. And Padraig Tobin was actually the first person who I saw when I went into Dublin Castle yesterday. I've never seen a happier looking man in my life. He was absolutely delighted. And he's kind of played a blinder with politically, I'm talking.
Because what was the mood outside of him among the politicians yesterday?
Desperate.
Sour?
Oh, absolutely desperate. I was kind of floating around early in the constituency results centre. I was trying to just get my bearings and figure out where to sit to write. You know yourself, Brenda, when you're trying to write copy and people come up and trying to talk to you and you're on a deadline. So I was trying to find somewhere quiet, basically, to sit.
And it sounds like there was no problem there.
Well, in the media centre, you know, us hacks love to chat and talk nonsense. But I went over to anyway, and I came out, and it was Roderick O'Gorman, his officials, and government representatives, and there wasn't really many other media representatives. And I kind of caught a sight of him really before he was getting himself ready for the cameras, and I did think he looked utterly crestfallen. Leo Varadkar then did a door-to-door press conference, and I think he tried to put a brave face, and he kind of came out and said, this is the 13th referendum to be rejected, you know, and the people have spoken and we're going to listen and we got it wrong, and basically it's like, and now we move on, was the sentiment. But throughout yesterday, from the moment the ballot boxes opened, and Kevin Humphreys was one of the first people, Labour's Kevin Humphreys, with the tally, I don't know whether you saw it.
He tweeted at half nine, didn't he?
Extraordinary for the no side. And that was replicated then. By 9:45 yesterday morning, my text messages were filling up with people already starting the blame game, and the finger was being pointed at Leo Varadkar. And throughout yesterday evening, there were party members then, as distinct to the politicians, who were messaging me and saying, this puts a series, like, for the first time within the party, people are talking about Leo Varadkar in a little bit of a different way. And one of the biggest issues they were talking about is the NGO's hold on members, not only Fine Gael, but Fianna Fáil, deep discomfort about this. And I would not be surprised if there is a conversation in the future politically about the funding of NGOs and their influence within government, because there are people within Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil who genuinely felt that the NGOs have more influence on the government than they themselves in their own party do.
Okay, well, evidence-based policy is what Aideen would call that. Mm. Come here, Leo Varadkar aside, this is not a great look for Roderick O'Gorman and the Greens either, is it? Adding to their kind of litany of, you know, slight wobbliness.
I think that's actually overly fair, in fairness, Brendan. But
I strive to be overly
I
fair.
I can tell. It's a terrible look, and I think that was really honestly reflected on his face yesterday. And he came out, and you could tell that it was a serious blow for him, also for his team around him, and for the Green Party generally. I think that they are just determined to try and get to next March, even though I don't believe the government will go to next March. They wanted to. I think they just want to get as many green things done as they can. And I really do believe we'll see more blow-ups between the Greens and the other two government parties as they try and get their final. I think that's what they're focused on. They'll obviously be deeply disappointed with this result, but I think they have their eye on the prize of getting as much done ahead of the next election.
Okay. We'll take a break. Brenda Power, Aideen Hayden, Jennifer Bray and Bobby McDonough are staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Brenda Power, Aideen Hayden, Jennifer Bray and Bobby McDonough are still with us. So we will move on. Brenda, I think this is another story that has kind of convulsed people as well in a different way. Ali Bracken is writing in the Sunday Independent about the Generous Garda, one unwanted bike, an OIP in need, and a story that intrigued the nation. This has been rumbling on for a few months, but we've kind of got closure on it now.
This is absolutely unbelievable if anybody is unfamiliar with the details.
I think start from the start.
Basically, yeah. During COVID, an elderly, isolated pensioner approached the local Garda station. His bike was beyond fixing, and he had no transport and he couldn't get to the shops for his groceries. And a Garda found a bike that had been handed in, a stolen bike that had been recovered, hadn't been claimed in more than a year, and gave it to him in an act of Christian charity, I would say, and common sense. And he didn't fill in the correct forms. I think that was one of the problems. But he was suspended, and he's been on suspension for 3 years. And I think
his
only
house,
recently.
His house descended upon three cars with six guards from the National
this
Crime
is a
Investigation
this,
Bureau.
Who usually investigate murders and serious crimes, investigating this man's case. He's a 30-year career in the Gardaí, and they say, you know, his career obviously would have begun at a time when paperwork probably wasn't as important, and, you know, community connectedness was much more to the fore in what he did, that he was actually doing, you know, a decent act for somebody in pretty dire straits. And the fact that this has taken so long to sort out, and that this man's career, and you can imagine the anxiety for him and his family over 3 years of this absolute nonsense.
And his main crime seemed to be he didn't fill out the right form. And then, Jennifer, according to that story as well, so the Garda Horkin investigation was going on. They were kind of it sounds like they were diverting guys who should have been down there to be interrogating this guard.
And it's extraordinary. Like, this Garda had a commendation for work that he had done. I think it was in relation to a drugs investigation. And during the time when he was diverting his attentions, basically away from paperwork or whatever it was, towards actually towards this work that he got a commendation for, this stuff was going on in the background. There was also a question raised about how this came to the attention of the NCBI. It seemed to have happened in quite an informal route. And I think anybody reading Ali Bracken's story will just look at it and go, what on earth is going on in the guards that they are spending so many time and resources? And as Brenda said, these are people who investigate murders and really serious crimes on a bike given to an elderly man during COVID that nobody had claimed, I think, in a year.
And was worth 50 euros, or less than 50
if
euros.
If even worth 50 euros. Absolutely extraordinary story.
Yeah. OK. Bobby, we shouldn't ignore the rest of the world. You picked Marion McKeown in the Business Post. And this is about... Joe Biden came back to life this week. Her headline is, "Debate on senility set the bar so low for Biden that Trump is now on the back foot," which is possibly an optimistic reading of it, but the State of the Union viewed as a triumph for Biden.
Yeah, well, it was certainly a step forward for Biden, and then he went and campaigned in Philadelphia afterwards. I mean, the election in the United States is the most important vote taking place in the world this year, possibly even this century. I mean, we have important elections coming up to the European Parliament. We've had our own, you know, referendum. But US democracy is at stake and America's role in the world. And I think I can understand why many people criticise Biden on Gaza. I think he deserves some criticism. But it would be madness of people to support a third candidate or to abstain because of that. Because if Trump gets elected, everything will be worse, including the situation in Gaza. So one looks for some degrees of optimism. There was a poll showing that in North Carolina, 80% of Nikki Haley's voters said they wouldn't vote for Trump. So, you know, there's definitely a lot to play for. I thought in that article by Marion McKeown, she made a good point about the contrast between the optimism of Joe Biden and the pessimism and negativity of Trump. Biden is trying to paint a picture of a better future where healthcare is extended and where, you know, the already fairly good employment situation improves further and so on. Whereas Trump in a recent speech said that America is dying. So, you know, he plays on the negativity and on exaggerating the negativity. And there's a little bit of a carryover to that in other countries, including this country. I mean, I'm not saying we should be naively optimistic about things, but we should be appropriately optimistic about things. Anyway, that's what Biden's trying to do, and we should hope
we all actually live, all of us on the team now live by your maxim that you said the last time you were here, which is optimism is a policy, isn't it? Is that what you said?
Well, absolutely. I think it shouldn't be foolish optimism.
You advise people on retirement and everything. Would you advise Biden and all that maybe it's time to retire and let the convention pick somebody else? Are we too late for that?
Well, he hasn't approached me. He mightn't be able to meet my fees. But no, I think the point about my coaching is that people have to make up their own decisions. So I don't tell them what to do. I help people to identify what their own priorities are. And if you want to make that sort of analogy, it's for Biden himself to decide what he wants to do. And it's very, very difficult for somebody to step back. I mean, in the way that Pope Benedict did, for example, it's very difficult for people to acknowledge that they're that they are actually replaceable. So Biden is making a calculation that which may be the correct one, that he has the best chance of beating Trump, as long as there isn't a further deterioration in his faculties. But no, I mean, I think he has to make his own call on that.
Aideen, with your political hat on, should Biden go, or does he have to stay the course now?
Oh, no, he has to stay the course at this stage. I think it's quite clear. It's a two-man race. I think he came out of the traps in good form. He did, a superb performance in his State of the Nation address. He managed to get a couple of swipes in about his age, which, you know, let's face it, Donald Trump isn't a million miles away from him. I think universally it's accepted that his State of the Nation speech went down very well. I think it's reassuring that he's taken a much more active stance in relation to Gaza, but that's an entire different matter. It's not boots on the ground, the building of this platform, but it's damn close to it. And in fact, there's question marks over whether they can put this platform into place without putting some boots on the ground. But I think the other thing that we have to be very aware of here is that this is a critical election for Ireland. I don't know if you saw it, but there was a statement from a senior NATO official who was speaking to the IIEA last week in Ireland. And he basically gave a very stark message that a war in Europe is not an if, it's a when. Yeah. And the situation in Ukraine is absolutely critical and is literally at the moment the only thing standing between us and a European war. So, look, the bottom line is quite simply, we should be, all of us who have a belief, crossing our selves and praying that Joe Biden gets elected. And I think it really is so critical for the Western world in general, and, you know, for a country that depends so much on its relationship with the United States, that this election goes in Biden's general direction. I think Trump is actually,
as we know, people
he's
just
more
won.
Engaged.
People
he's worse than he's worse this time now than he was last time,
and stronger than ever,
and stronger
as well.
But
as we now know, this weekend in this country, people just won't do what they're told in elections. That's Bobby, I just, not to ignore the other two panels, but Bobby, can I go back to you for that for a second? In terms of, this came out of the Munich Security Council as well, where a lot of reports out of it were saying that NATO are saying it's not if, it's when. They're operating on 100% assumption that Russia invades a European country within the next 5 to 7 years. Is that alarmist?
I think that's a bit alarmist. I mean, it's no harm ringing an alarm bell. But to say that it's inevitable, I think, is an exaggeration. But it's a very serious risk, and we have to take it seriously. And, you know, a big event this week was that Sweden eventually was accepted into NATO. Now, Sweden is a country that is every bit as decent as Ireland in terms of its approach to international affairs. The difference between Sweden and Ireland is its geography. Now, with our geography, we can, if we want, kick the can down the road. We can engage in sort of small practical ways, as we are increasingly doing with security cooperation in Europe and as a member for Partnership for Peace with NATO. But there is a question there for us. The world may change significantly if all comes to the worst in Ukraine, or if Putin invades one of our EU partners.
Yeah,
so we have to grow up and be serious.
Too,
I don't know what the answer is, but we have to. It's not just a lighthearted debate about what people are feeling when they wake up in the morning. It's a very serious question.
Yeah. And geography has changed as well, which we all recognise, that our geography doesn't protect us the way it used to in a world of modern hybrid warfare and all that. Okay, look, there's lots of other stuff I wanted to get to. Jennifer, the Sunday Times, Murphy leads Irish charge for Oscar's glory.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking Cillian Murphy is not the first Cork man to be accused of being deserving of an Oscar, I'd have to say, but he could be the first one to win it.
Yeah, and you know, the piece referenced the fact that there's sort of a lot resting on his shoulders. I think people were very disappointed after the rugby result, particularly when it's a last minute dropkick. I was trying my best, there was a screen in the Count Centre, to watch it over the other the actual things that were unfolding in Dublin Castle, but I couldn't really pay attention. I was raging and a little bit happy because I would have been so disappointed. And I think now there's a lot of people kind of looking to Cillian Murphy for that sort of Irish boost. I think he genuinely has a fantastic chance. I think it's his to lose, really. I only watched Oppenheimer there last week, and I thought it was, I would not normally be into a film that long. I'd really check out and fall asleep. And I, by the end of it, I was like, I'd watch it again the next week. It was just, it's fantastic. And you can't take your eyes off him. Like, he's such a talent. So yeah. I'm hoping that he wins it. We all are, I think.
Yeah, I think he will.
You do?
I think stillness is his great talent. Mm-hmm. He's like, it sounds like not a major talent, but to be still the way he is still.
Barry Keoghan has a bit of that as well, doesn't he? That kind of, there's something in his face, really, that you can't take your eyes off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see, Irishmen having their time. And Brenda, you picked a piece in the Sunday Independent. Jim Sheridan is set to make a film about the Kerry babies. And the way Jim Sheridan talks about this story, actually, he does make it sound like an epic story for the times, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, it is when you remember the details of the Kerry baby story. And of course, it has come back into the fore in recent years with the identification of the baby's parents. And of course, Jim took a very particular stance on the Ian Bailey story. So it will be very interesting to see what his take on this particular one is. But this is, when you think about it, when you go back through the details of it and the tribunal and everything that emerged there, it is an extraordinary story. And it'll be, I'd say, a bit of an eye-opener for a generation that didn't know what went on in those days. I remember I was a very young student reporter and going to the tribunal when it was in Dublin Castle, just to cover it briefly. And I remember sitting there one day and seeing a picture. One of the lawyers had left open a booklet of photographs and a picture of the baby's body, which I will never unsee.
Yeah.
The baby that was found on the beach. And all that unfolded from that. And I mean, there was a sense that that particular infant was lost in all that subsequently unfolded, because that was an absolutely savage murder.
When you were going down to that at that time, did you think you were living in modern kind of Ireland at that stage? We did, didn't we?
Like, we did, yeah. We would say, this is 1984.
Yeah. Just a couple of other miscellaneous. We should mention Mother's Day. Mother's Day feels such a loaded thing over the weekend that's in it, and the way that there was an International Women's Day rebellion and everything. But Aideen, you have picked a piece in the Sunday Times. It's their editorial, actually. They're giving it due importance. Say It Without Chocolates.
Absolutely. I find this a bit weird. There's a study done that one group had a sugar-rich breakfast in either between jam and croissants or whatever, and the second group had what you'd call a healthy breakfast with brown bread and various oatmeal and whatever. The first group, they photographed 2 hours later, and it was clear that they didn't look quite as good as the second group, who were also photographed 2 hours later. So the moral of the story is, you can give your mother chocolates in the evening when maybe it doesn't matter. Or at least if you've forgotten to give her the chocolates, you can at least say it's because she'd look better in the photographs.
Don't start the day on sugar.
Don't start the day on sugar. Basically, if you're planning on having yourself photographed, that's the bottom line of it.
Yeah, and I read that survey and it said they looked pale and clammy.
Pale and clammy.
Probably because they were being photographed.
You know, what about all the Italians and the French who start their mornings with hot chocolate?
They were being shamed.
Croissant, you know.
This was a French study, I believe. It was a French study.
Speaking of pale, if not clammy, Jennifer, the Sunday Independent, Red or Alive, Redhead's Demise Spark Photographer's Project. You've taken this one personally?
Taking this one personally. This was a former National Geographic photographer who did this kind of 500 portraits of redheads. But he didn't photograph any Irish women, despite the fact that he said it was all inspired by the fact that he associates red hair with Ireland. But there was one line in it basically where it says, they've noticed amongst younger generation, they don't really slag redheads, really. Don't call them like carrot top or ginger or whatever. And I can testify that somewhere around the age of 20, people stopped slagging me. And it was only around 20 up until that point. Something changed. There was a cultural shift. And now I'm not so much the pariah.
I think has it become a more desirable attribute as time has gone on, hasn't it?
Well, anytime I go to the hairdresser, they always say nice things about my hair. It's probably the only thing I've ever really like consistently liked about myself. So, yeah, I never paid attention to the bullies. And there was much worse phrases, may I say, that cannot be repeated on here.
Really?
Yeah, there were songs and everything, I'm telling you.
I've never understood that. I mean, I think red is the most gorgeous hair colour you can possibly
have. You're kind of a redhead.
Well, not really, but, you know.
By choice.
A lot of Irish people have a red tinge. The trouble is, it's being bred out now. It's a recessive gene, so... Mm-hmm. the...
You're telling me to have lots of kids.
Well, yes, absolutely. But in a couple of generations.
Do two redheads have to get together to be guaranteed to create redheads? Is that it?
It's like almost if there's an uncle scene or an aunt, that seems to... I don't know why.
Well, clearly not, because Prince Harry, who is a redhead, is married to a woman who's not a redhead, and both of his children seem to have redheads.
Red is a colour that helps people to win sporting events. You know, there's been an analysis of boxing matches at the Olympics where you're either in the blue or the red corner. It ought to be 50-50.
Yeah.
But the red corner wins something like 58% of the time. So
I'm not feeling that in my personal life.
Yeah, we won't start using words like fiery and feisty and all that kind of thing.
I will accept that though.
Okay, fair enough. And thank you very much to all my feisty panel this morning. Dr. Margaret Kendi was with us earlier, and just a text on that. Listening to Margaret, delighted she feels the people of Ireland have shown they want more and better for her disabled family and friends. And look, that is one interpretation of what happened. And there are many, as you've heard this morning, interpretations of what went on. But I think that was a very enlightening discussion on it. Brenda Power, Aideen Hayden, Jennifer Bray and Bobby McDonough, thank you very much. And it's just 12 noon and we'll go to the newsroom and Kate Egan.